This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This past June, U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez moderated a conference called Pathways to Prosperity, How Public and Private Sectors Can Put People with Criminal Records to Work.
One of the most important things you can do to prevent recidivism is to find people the opportunities for sustainable jobs that enable them to support themselves and their families and their communities.
But getting jobs for ex-offenders is just one of the many issues that they and we as society need to grapple with. There's reintegration into a civil society that works an awful lot different than prison society. There's the reality that many former inmates return to neighborhoods where the potential and prospects for recidivism are just too good. According to a 2012 study by Connecticut's Criminal Policy and Planning Division, 79% of inmates released in 2005 were rearrested within just 5 years. So how do we make progress on reentry into society for prisoners? And what else can we do to break a cycle of repeat incarceration? As you heard this morning in a story from Lucy Nalpathanchil from WNPR, drug courts at the federal and state level are trying to do just that by giving people an opportunity to seek treatment to avoid going back to prison. And as you'll hear later in this program, Connecticut has programs like Family Reentry, trying to find solutions for how to support the 12,000 ex-offenders released from prison each year in our state, many of whom don't have violent pasts, but find it a struggle to take the next step once leaving prison. One question, though, is what exactly to do with inmates, those who've spent decades behind bars for crimes that are much more serious than drug possession? Laura Sullivan of NPR is an investigative correspondent who reported on prisoners in Colorado for a series called Life After Life, Aging Inmates Struggle for Redemption. We're going to start our program with Laura, who joins us from Washington today. Laura Sullivan, welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I'm wondering if you can describe what drew you to this story, because you've covered criminal justice for years, but this story of aging inmates in Colorado and their attempts to find a way to get out of prison in a way that really makes sense for them.
I think that, you know, this is something that because I've covered it for so long that I kept hearing about and seeing in it, and it percolated through every story that I've done about the sort of the growing number of people in prison in the country and the length of prison sentences. Most people still get out of prison at some point, and so the age of people coming back home from prison is getting older and older. And so I wanted to follow a group of inmates through that process. And Colorado, it's not always easy. I mean, most Department of Corrections throughout the country are really reticent to allow media to do this, and they're not sure what it's going to look like or what you really are going to do. And it's hard to get into facilities. It's hard to get them to sort of trust your project and you. But Colorado came through, and they really were sort of amazing, and which was great because they have this program. It's the only one of its kind in the country where they are sort of trying to help aging inmates as they come out of prison make it on the outside. And it's a very special group. It's harder for them than it is for younger people.
And that's one of the really important things, I think, about this story. It's that we are going to spend some time later in our program talking about this reentry cycle in which people get out and then they get back in. And a lot of these are younger people who are going back to neighborhoods in which they reoffend, and it happens again. And we're trying to break that cycle as a country. But you're dealing here with men who've been behind bars for such a long time that it's really the only thing they know. Maybe you can describe a little bit more about these inmates that you got a chance to know.
So some of them, they range in age and anywhere from their late 40s up until their 70s and early 80s. There was one gentleman. They have, for the most part, been in prison for decades, 30 decades, you know. I mean, 3 decades, 2 decades, 3 decades, 4 decades. And when you think about that amount of time, these are men who don't know how to use cell phones. I mean, they don't know how to, you know, use the technology, you know, the internet, how to get jobs, use computers. Everything is so different from when they went to prison. This is a group of people, the number one predictor of whether or not somebody's going to recidivate when they get out of prison, the number one thing that you can sort of hang your hat on is age. So for the most part, these are older guys who are not looking to get back into a life of crime, but at the same time, life is harder to adapt to. They didn't spend 10 years and now they're 38 years old and they're going to get back out and it sort of looks the same as when they left. When you spend 30 something years in prison, it's going to look a whole lot different. And after, you know, a lot of these guys, and I know you're going to hear from some of them today, is that, you know, they really feel institutionalized, where for 30 years they've been told whether or not they can step from this room into the next room. And then all of a sudden, one day they're released. And Colorado, like most states, used to just hand, you know, a 78-year-old guy a bus ticket and $100 and drop him off at the bus stop in Denver and say, show up at your parole officer's office in a week and don't get in any trouble. And it wasn't working at all. And these, what they actually found was that some of these guys were reoffending on purpose because they wanted to go home. And by home, I mean prison, where all their friends are, where their life is, where their community is. When you spend 30-something years somewhere and you're 70-something years old, that's your life. Your family may have already passed. You don't really have those connections anymore. And this, and there was one guy that walked into a liquor store and put a gun on the counter and said, I don't want to hurt anybody, but I want to go back to prison. Can you call the police? And that is a problem for Colorado because it costs a fortune. I mean, that's the thing. And I think that's what I wanted to get at with in this story is whether or not as a society, what do we want to do? And it's a difficult question. You know, do we want to throw our money at the, you know, toward this, or do we want it toward incarcerating them because we believe society's safer, or because we believe a price needs to be exacted? And that, and that's, you know, a lot of people go on that side. And then there's another side of the pendulum that says it's too expensive, we can't afford it. You know, let's try to let them out. And it's, you know, it's a difficult question.
We're talking with Laura Sullivan, who's an NPR reporter who did a series in June called Life After Life, Aging Inmates Struggle for Redemption. Let's hear one of the voices from this story.
I'm not advocating for people to be released. What I'm doing is looking at a reality that they are getting released. Shame on us. Shame on us for seeing people in our prison system that are eventually going to be released and giving them nothing, nothing to prepare them for.
And Laura, that's Tim Hand speaking your story. This, it gets right to the heart of what you're talking about. Because these men are going to be released, sometimes sentenced in a, in an age when they weren't getting life sentences without parole, but indeed they were actually getting sentences of 20, 30, 40 years with parole, we probably need to figure out some realistic way for them to reintegrate into society.
Right. And that's, and Tim Hand had to, he was the one who created this program in Colorado, and he had to walk a really fine line because, you know, right now our society is saying, you know, lock them up, throw away the key. Life means life. Life without parole, you spend the rest of your life in prison and you die there. At the same time, a lot of these guys, if you're sentenced in the 70s, 80s, or late 80s, even into the early 90s, your life sentence is probably 20 to life or maybe 30 to life. Nowadays, it's 60 to life or life without parole. So back then, so these guys, there's a pool of people in prison right now that, that are getting released right now. If you have a 30 to life sentence that you were sentenced, you know, and you know, 1985, it's coming up. So, you know, you know, it was difficult for him because he can't go in front of the parole board or in front of, you know, politicians or sort of, you know, the movement in politics right now is tough on crime. It's still, it's changing a little bit, but it's still very tough on crime, and say, well, we don't want to spend $100,000 a year paying for this guy to stay in prison. You know, if Colorado can release 14 of these guys, they save $1 million a year. And so that's something. On the other side, you know, they could put that money toward anything. And on the other side is this idea that you really, you can't just, if you've committed a heinous crime, and you have committed a heinous crime, if you're in prison, if you got 30 to life in 1980, you committed something, you did something bad. You do something real bad. And so there's an idea also that, that you don't ever get another chance. You don't get a chance at rehabilitation.
But I think even beyond that, too, in this next cut we're going to play, you're speaking with an inmate who you feature, you know, quite a powerful story of John Huckleberry. He's talking here a little bit about the trust that anyone might have in these guys getting out and whether or not they are going to commit a crime again, whether or not we can trust them to be good citizens. Let's listen to a little bit of the story where you're talking with John Huckleberry.
Huckleberry's followed all the rules of this program. He used to cost taxpayers almost $70,000 a year in prison. Now he's been paying taxes. I asked him how people are supposed to know whether to give someone like him a chance.
You don't. It's a leap of faith. I hope when he gets out, he does the right thing. You don't know if he's going to, or you don't know if I'm going to or not. I don't know these guys coming out. I don't know. And I've known them, right?
Look at Red Thorpe, he tells me.
And there you go. A crime that was real heavy.
Yes.
But look at what he's done. Don't you have to separate the man that did the deed years and years ago and the man that he's become? You're on the outside. Don't you say, wow, how did he get here from there?
That's a former inmate, John Huckleberry, talking with NPR's Laura Sullivan in the series Life After Life, Aging Inmates Struggle for Redemption. Huckleberry is a man who killed his wife. And the other gentleman he talks about there, Red Thorpe, is someone who committed a very, very heinous act. And he's asking, I think, one of the right questions here, Laura, is how do we trust? How do we say this is someone who deserves now to get out of jail after doing things that they can quite rightly say after all these years, yeah, we shouldn't have done that. We should have paid a price.
Right. And whether or not they deserve the opportunity to change. That's what I think that's the question for society right now, is what do we believe in? Do we want to let people change and feel sorry for their crimes? Because that's what real change really is. Or do we want them to not have to be punished, to just stay where they are? Huckleberry, is an easy part of this story because in some ways he committed one crime in his whole life. It was he had a tumultuous relationship with his wife, and during a fight he ran her over with his truck. He spent 30 some years in prison for that, and now he's released. So as taxpayers, we're no longer paying for that. He's now paying taxes, as you heard in the clip. And he is living a life free of crime, and he's contributing back to society. It's sort of a single incident. It's like this is what he did, and he, has expressed remorse ever since. However, on the other side of it is Red Thorpe, which is a more difficult story because Red Thorpe killed a 16-year-old boy when he was 22 years old, and. When you hear, he attempted to sort of drown him in a lake and then ended up strangling him. And it is this heart-wrenching story. However, when you look at Red Thorpe right now, he has done so much. He has taught 400 underprivileged kids how to, to take the GED and to pass it. He's an educator. He's gotten his PhD. He is the mentor of this program. There are 34 men in it. Not a single one has committed a crime. He's helped every single one of them find a place to live and learn how to make it work on the outside. He gives his entire life to others. And it is all in this act of seeking redemption. And when I talk to him, though, he can't find that redemption because he is so, it's been 40 some years since he committed that crime, but he can't, it's almost like the more human that he has become in all of these years, the more unable he is to live with what he did. And so he struggles with suicide, with trying to stay alive. He has adopted his wife's children. He says he lives for them at this point. And, if you met him on the street, you would think he was one of the kindest people you ever met.
I want to introduce another character in these stories that Laura Sullivan reported. Greg Wells is one of the subjects of the Life After Life segment. He joins us by phone now. Greg Wells, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you've been listening through to a little bit of our conversation. I guess I'm wondering if you can tell us briefly your story and how you feel like you turned your life around, how things have been for you outside of prison.
Well, briefly, I did 36 years on what's called a felony murder case. And while inside, I kind of wanted to be a knucklehead for a while. And after some awakening in the early 90s, I started doing a lot of mental health classes, therapeutic community for drug and alcohol abuse. I was a heroin addict for about 20 years. And I got lucky and was asked to be a part of this long-term offender program and be the first lifer to get out through it. I think the most difficult part about even with all the preparation inside for pre-release and continued cognitive behavior therapy and dialectic behavior therapy and some computer schooling and different things like that, it kind of prepares you for what you're going to be seeing. But at the same time, anybody that comes out after serving 20, 30 or more years is so overwhelmed with, first off, with the emotional experience of coming out and just the fast-paced life, and then trying to work on things rationally so that you can apply what you learned inside, whether it's looking for a job, applying for applications on job for jobs online, even like Laura said, cell phones. Everybody's on a phone out here, and of course, that wasn't around 30 years ago. So, I think that the main part is just being overwhelmed at the speed of life when you come out.
Well, what are the things that you think helped you the most to make that transition? And as we continue our conversation in just a little bit about some of the prison reentry programs we have here in Connecticut, what would you say to policymakers or just the public that might help people who are getting out of prison, who've maybe been there for a long time, to take the next step that you have, Greg?
I think that the best thing that any Department of Corrections, regardless of what state you're in, is to have an extensive reentry program. We call it pre-release out here. And it's where you're able to find out different resources, whether you're going to go through Social Security, food stamps, clothing banks, food banks, learning how to budget money when you get out. There's a lot of modules that we use in our pre-release program that allow you to set on paper or on a computer disk so that when you get out, because you're going to forget things, but it gives you something to focus on to know, okay, well, this didn't work, so I'm going to try this next one. And you just have a multiple plan for, like, okay, if A doesn't work, I go to B. If B doesn't work, I go to C. But it's imperative that for reentry programs that they have a lot of support from the outside.
Laura, before we end this segment, I guess I'm just wondering if there's anything that you can tell us about your interactions with Greg or any of these other inmates, maybe things that even changed your mind as a reporter as you went in on this assignment trying to figure out this entire world.
So when I first met Greg, he had just gotten out, and he had been out like a week or two when I first met this whole program and went to the halfway house. And he was very, a little bit shy. He was kind of reserved. He kind of had like a deer in the headlights look, as he often talks about some of the other guys. The next time I went back a few months later, it suddenly, like, I didn't even know his whole personality. He is hilarious. He is definitely the guy who tells the jokes in the room, makes everybody laugh. He's kind of the glue, is what I sort of saw in the way this group interacted with each other, where Greg would always sort of keep the mood together. And when things would get really heavy, as it often did in these meetings, where they would start talking about, you know, how hard this was and how difficult it all had been, he would just come in and say these hilarious things. And he also now has become one of the greatest mentors of this group, because his in particular, because Greg, he was in prison for 36 years, really is one of the most successful members of the program, who has really just embraced life on the outside and has just, you know, adopted everything that's been thrown at him. So it's been great to see you doing so well, Greg.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, Greg Wells, thank you very much for sharing some of your story and for being such a big part of Laura's reporting in this Life After Life segment. I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Again, I thank you. Have a nice day.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue with Laura Sullivan from NPR, and we're going to talk more about reentry programs right here in Connecticut. And we want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always email us where we live at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about prison reentry. for the many inmates who get out of Connecticut's prisons. What do they do after sometimes many years behind bars, not just getting jobs, but also just reintegrating into a society that maybe has left them behind? That's been one of the things we've been talking about. Laura Sullivan from NPR did a series called Life After Life, Aging Inmates Struggle for Redemption. She profiled a Colorado program that helps elderly inmates, some who've been behind bars for some time, reintegrate into society. She joins us today from Washington. Joining us now by phone is Mike Lawler. He's Undersecretary of Connecticut's Criminal Justice Policy and Planning Division. He's joined us in the past, of course, to talk about these issues. And Mike Lawler, good to speak with you once again.
Hey, good morning, John. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. We just heard about this Colorado program, and we've heard for some years that Connecticut has been on the leading edge of reentry programs in the state. Maybe you can give us just an update as to where you think Connecticut is right now as far as providing for the inmates who are getting out of prison, and how much further you think we need to get.
Well, we are on the leading edge. There's a bunch of states. Interestingly, states like Texas and Kansas are joining Ohio and New York. And Connecticut and New Jersey, so it's kind of a mixture of red and blue states, have figured out that there are some smart on crime approaches that will lower crime and lower recidivism. So we're definitely on the leading edge. The most important thing to keep in mind is in a state like Connecticut, we've got almost 20,000 people coming out of prison every year. And they're having finished just a few days in prison or in some cases a few decades. And so sorting them out and hooking them up with appropriate supervision and treatment once they're coming into the community is a formidable challenge, right? It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. And more importantly, people are realizing now that you have to start this process long before they head out the door of the prison. So there's interventions in the facility that are geared towards reentry, sort of prepping people to find a job, prepping people to make sure they continue with whatever medical treatment they need, mental health treatment, making sure they have insurance as they go out the door, making sure they have a driver's license as they go out the door. All of these things we've seen over time contribute to lower recidivism, which is our goal here.
I'm wondering if you can maybe parse out some of the different types of inmates, though, who come out of prison. As we've been hearing from Laura Sullivan, some men and women spend quite a bit of time behind bars. During that time, they're able to gain skills, sometimes get a GED or maybe even college education. They mentor people, and they certainly come to grips with what they've done. On the other end, you have people who come in and out of our prison system seemingly almost every year. You said before, Mike Lawler, that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution, but how do you deal with these two groups, these very different groups, differently in terms of how they may reintegrate into society?
Well, let's take the second group, the sort of frequent flyers in the system. They're coming in for relatively short periods of time, in and out, in and out, in and out. There's a very high proportion of these folks who are mentally ill, who are, generally speaking, homeless, who are substance abusers. I mean, all of those things together. And we found that by hooking them up with housing and appropriate treatment, we can more often than not get them into some kind of stable situation, which becomes self-sustaining over time. So we have this program called FUSE, which is frequent user or something. I don't know what it all stands for, but the bottom line is they target these guys, the guys who are coming in and out. They're not high risk. They're not dangerous. They're just frequent flyers in the system. And the recidivism rate among this group is very, very low if you can get them involved in this type of an intervention. So that's a specialized approach to one specific type of offender. But, you know, then you have sex offenders, right? There's a lot of obstacles for sex offenders finishing their prison terms, you know, not just employment, but where they're even allowed to live. So what you don't want is guys like this in a homeless shelter with no supervision. And frequently that is the case. So we've tried to develop a residential transition for guys in this category. So, for example, we opened a sort of a halfway house for sex offenders finishing long prison sentences. It's on the grounds of the prison in Montville, but it's geared toward ensuring that since they're going back into the community, that transition is a smooth one. And if they're going to reoffend, we want to have very close supervision on them as they go through this 6 or 7 month process of reentry. So, again, you want to look at risk, you want to look at needs, and if you get the balance correct, you can really drop the recidivism rate pretty dramatically.
We're going to take some calls at 860-275-7266. Valentine is on the line from Hartford. Hi, Valentine. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. I'm calling to add an element to what people have already said, which is that reentry begins before you leave the prison. And I volunteer, have for many years, in the prisons with something called the Alternatives to Violence Project, which is a series of weekend-long workshops in which people can practice ways of dealing with conflict. You can't ever eliminate conflict. That's part of life. But dealing with conflict without physical or verbal violence. And I'm told it's the most popular program at McDougal, where I facilitate. And studies have shown that people who do this program, and I'm sure there are similar ones, have a lower rate of recidivism because they've learned to observe and control their anger instead of reacting immediately with violence.
Mm. Valentine, thank you for telling us about that program. And if others want to join us with some thoughts like these, 860-275-7266. Before we move into some folks who are running reentry programs here in the state, I just want to go back quickly to Laura Sullivan. Mike Lawler just said a moment ago that there seems to be almost a red state, blue state consortium, states for very different reasons, some of them financial and some other, to really get a handle on this issue. Do you see any national trends, Laura, in the way the states or maybe the federal government even are trying to deal with the issue of prison reentry?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a giant train that is just barreling down the pike for states right now. The cost of incarceration in this country right now is too much for states to handle. And so even states that initially were the toughest on crime, lock them up, you know, throw away the key, like Texas, have completely turned around and said, okay, actually, that's a little more pricey than we expected, and we cannot have all of these different facilities. Texas has actually closed one of its prisons, saving millions and millions of dollars a year. It's two-pronged. One, it's taking a look at some of the sentences, wondering if some of them are too long, if there is a way to let people out at some point. And then the other part of it is to keep people from coming back because the cost is so exorbitant. And if you look at, you know, just to get back to aging, I mean, the number of in 1982, there were, you know, 8,000 inmates over, you know, who were considered elderly in prison. And right now there's 120,000 something. And by 2030, there's going to be 400,000 elderly inmates in prison. That's billions of dollars per state. I mean, that's going to cost more than higher education in most states. And so it's a question of where do you want to put your resources? And I think a lot of state officials are saying not there, because that's money down the drain. So I think there's a huge shift. I mean, you know, after the economics of, you know, went into the tank a few years ago, a lot of the programs dialed back a bit after this big growth. But now in the past year or two, they're starting to come back again. And it's interesting what the previous caller was saying about anger. That's one of the things that is one of the most difficult things to come out of this penitentiary idea after all these years in prison, is that one of the inmates that I spent a lot of time following went to McDonald's, and a guy cut in line. And, you know, there was a sense of, well, if you did that in prison, well, you know, you don't survive that. You don't break rules like that in prison. And you have to really kind of learn to just say, it's just McDonald's, I'm just going to swallow it.
Well, and this is at such an important point. Mike Lawler, we're going to, in just a moment, be turning to some people who are really working on the reentry piece of this. But before we go any further, I just want to get back to on the prosecution end. We heard this morning Lucy Nalpathanchil reporting on expanded drug courts in the federal system. I think, and I know you've worked on this for years, Mike, it's really important to think about how do we get people not even to go into prison in the first place, a place where anger and uncivil society just holds sway, and it almost seems impossible to get people out of that system once they're there. I think one thing we're trying to do and that we need to probably do better is just keep people out of prison in the first place, Mike.
Yeah, that's certainly true, but I think it's really important to keep in mind that aside from the cost factor involved in this policy debate, what we've really figured out is you can actually reduce crime a lot if you get it right. And so in Connecticut, crime is down at its lowest point since the late 1960s. I mean, it's been a very dramatic drop in reported crime, crime with victims, right? That's really happening. And as a result, there's a lot fewer people coming into prison. And as a result, there's a lot fewer people in prison. So the goal here is to prevent people from committing crimes and therefore preventing their return to prison. Now, having said that, if you're going to have prisons, it's a very expensive and not particularly effective sanction for most people, right? So you want to reserve prisons for the highest risk, most dangerous offenders. And I think that's what you see happening in Connecticut and a lot of states. You recall Governor Malloy proposed decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. That's one of a number of initiatives that's geared towards getting the criminal justice system to focus on higher risk, dangerous offenders. And I think you're going to see that going forward in Connecticut and a lot of states, that prisons are there for a reason, and there's people that deserve to be in them, but there's a lot of people in prison today who really don't need to be there, and that's what we're trying to get right.
We're talking with Mike Lawler, who's Undersecretary of Connecticut's Criminal Justice Policy and Planning Division. Also joining us from Washington, D.C. today is Laura Sullivan. She's an NPR investigative reporter whose series Life After Life, Aging Inmates Struggle for Redemption, got us thinking about this issue. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I want to bring in Steve Lanza, who is Executive and Clinical Director of Family Reentry, Inc. in Connecticut. And Steve, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, John, for having me.
I'm wondering if you can explain what family reentry does, how it fits into this matrix that we've been talking about trying to find ways to get people better lives after they get out from behind bars.
Sure, absolutely. One of the areas that we focus very heavily on is the reentry process. We do other things as well, as you mentioned earlier, trying to go as sort of far upstream as possible to help people before they actually enter the criminal justice system in the first place. And we do some of that work as well. But focusing on the reentry piece, these are complex issues, and there are no simple or single solutions to them. And there are clearly many good people working on these issues across the state of Connecticut, and there are many wonderful and innovative programs. There are many obstacles. I think the key task here is, as Undersecretary Lawler said, is that really the ability to manage risk, to use prison for what it's best for. And in terms of the reentry process, for those 20,000 or so people that are coming back from prisons and jails in Connecticut each year, is to be sure that we can assess risk and need appropriately, that we can provide the services, particularly the mental health services and substance abuse treatment that many people are struggling with before they went into prison, and may be actually one of the causal or contributing factors as to why they got there in the first place. But being able to do a very good job both while they're in the facilities, but also on the transition from prison to the community. And as Undersecretary Lawler said, clearly getting into the prisons, doing pre-release work with incarcerated clients prior to their release and helping prepare them and helping to pave the way in the community for their reentry is critical. There are so many stakeholders in this issue. Clearly, the private sectors, businesses, communities, family members, nonprofits, federal and state government, and getting all the stakeholders to understand the importance of the issue and the unintended consequences and collateral damage that these policies and practices since the mid-70s have really brought to communities and to the state and to the budget. So I think some of the things that are really critical here are getting in early and helping people prepare for release as soon as possible, having as smooth a transition as possible to the community, and providing the supports in the community that people need. And that will include a broad range of things, from housing to job training to education to mental health, substance abuse, managing just daily tasks of life, particularly for those people that have been in prison for quite a long period of time.
One of the things I want to ask you about, though, is I think paving that way for people and giving people the tools they need is clearly something the state needs to do, but there's this trust issue that we talked about earlier in the program, mm-hmm. that whether it's employers or neighbors, once people find out that someone is coming back to their neighborhood after having served time in jail, sometimes for something that is violent, not just necessarily for a nonviolent drug offense, there is an awful lot of community buy-in that has to happen, and certainly at the employer level. Steve, I guess I'm wondering if I can ask you what to do about that, how to make it so that employers might take a second look at someone who comes out with a criminal record and needs to find a job in order to be productive.
Well, there are a number of initiatives across the state working on addressing that very, very specifically by going to employers and employer groups, Connecticut Business and Industry Association and local and regional business and industry associations, and talking to them about the importance of hiring prepared ex-offenders. The reality is that in good reentry programs, people are eager to work, eager to be productive. And if the issues that might be problematic have been addressed, you know, managing emotions in the workplace, dealing with issues of substance abuse and relationships issues in their lives, dealing with any mental health issues that they may or may not have, any trauma issues, if those can be effectively addressed and managed, then people are better prepared for work. And those, in our experience, men and women coming out of prison who are well prepared make actually far better employees than the average person in many ways, because they are prepared and they are eager to work and they are eager to stay out of prison. So I think it's a matter of convincing employers that there's an opportunity here instead of a problem, that the risk is being managed appropriately. And in fact, if you get a little bit of a track record with some successful programs or initiatives or even one or two people that have been successful in a particular place of employment, then that starts to grow exponentially. There's really not a better promotion for this than successful ex-offenders themselves being the champions of these causes, folks that have come out and done well, and being the voices and being at the tables of influence so that they can actually be the demonstration that things, this can actually work. And the evidence is very clear, it can work. And we just have to make sure that we're doing a very good job on implementing all of the policies and practices that clearly most people realize will be effective.
We're going to have to take a break. I want to thank Steve Lanza, who's Executive and Clinical Director of Family Reentry in Connecticut. Thanks so much for joining us, Steve. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I also want to thank Mike Lawler. He's Undersecretary of Connecticut's Criminal Justice Policy and Planning Division. He's joined us to talk about these issues before, and I'm really glad you're able to join us once again, Mike.
No problem, John. Good talking to you.
And thanks to Laura Sullivan. She's NPR's investigative reporter. She got us thinking about this entire issue with her series Life After Life, Aging Inmates Struggle for Redemption. Laura joined us today from Washington. Laura, thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to hear from another ex-offender, and we're also going to be taking some of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We're just a week away from the Republican primary, and there are a lot of ads on the air, you might have noticed. So we'll be certainly talking about that. Also, I know this will shock you, another controversial decision by the mayor of East Haven. Yes, East Haven in the news once again. That's on The Wheelhouse tomorrow. Hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about prison reentry. We've been talking with a reporter in Washington, D.C. at NPR about her series on Colorado. We've been talking with some people who handle prison reentry programs here in Connecticut. And we're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Sean is calling from Milford. Hi there, Sean.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to call and ask about something called a cost of incarceration lien. And I'm not exactly sure how it works, but my understanding is that for all the time that you're in prison, the state somehow calculates how much it costs to incarcerate you and then keeps that amount kind of hanging over your head in the event that you inherit a house or make enough money to pay back that lien. And it seems to me that if the idea is to get folks out with a clean slate and incentivize them to work and to accumulate wealth and to generate, you know, to be productive, it seems like having a lien for their cost of incarceration hanging over their head is counterproductive.
Well, Sean, let me actually put that, and that's something I don't know much about. Let me put that to John Santa. He actually joins us. He's from the Malta Justice Initiative, and he joins us on the phone. John, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Did you hear what Sean had to say from Milford? Do you know anything about the cost of incarceration lien?
I'm not familiar with that, I'm sorry to say. I don't know that.
And he's talking about it as a potential disincentive. We'll try to learn a little bit more. I'd like to
sure,
learn a little bit more about...
People that go to prison pay large enough prices in 16 different ways.
Well, so, I'm wondering if you can maybe tell us a little bit about your program. We've been talking about various prison reentry programs. Tell us about yours.
Be happy to, John. We're part of the Order of Malta, which is a worldwide organization of Catholic, Roman Catholic lay people. We do work on behalf of sick and poor people in nations all around the world. In particular, here in Connecticut, where we saw ourselves as Malta Justice Initiative, and we're working to educate and inform people about about the conditions of criminal justice and how we could improve them, the opportunity to improve them, more particularly, and to your particular interest, one of the programs we work on is an item called Prodigal Project, in which we seek to influence public opinion, and more specifically employers, about how hiring ex-offenders is actually in their own enlightened self-interest. And it kind of begins with a basic threshold question: would you rather have an ex-offender on the street with a job or without a job? And you know, obviously, you know the answer to that. But the thing is, when that ex-offender is on the street with a job, they're supporting themselves, they're supporting their family, they're less criminogenic, and call me crazy, they're paying taxes. What's wrong with that?
Mm.
Okay. So therefore, what we look for and what we try to support and encourage business owners and public opinion to support are what we call qualified ex-offenders. This is something like what Steve Lance was talking about. A qualified ex-offender, because, by the way, everybody gets out of prison isn't ready to go back to work. Some of them have never even been to work. Some of them don't know how to work. Okay, so we got to take that into account. Now, that said, there are lots and lots and lots of them that do want a job. And we consider them qualified for a job if two things are true. Number one, they're working on their recovery and or mental issues. And secondly, they're connected to a good social service agency, which here in Connecticut, we are blessed with many, many of them.
Hmm.
Community Partners in Action, Career Resources, Family Reentry. We have lots of very, very good ones that are ready there to help people coming out, and they stand ready. But of course, you know, our ex-offenders have to be ready to help themselves too. I think what's helpful for people to understand is that 9 out of 10 people that go to prison are addicted and or mentally ill.
Well, I want to actually hear from another ex-offender who's going to join us on the phone now, so I'll let you go. But John, in case people want to find out more, it's MaltaJusticeInitiative.org. John Santa from the Malta Justice Initiative, thank you so much for joining us. I want to go to Jeff Brenneman, who's a recently released ex-offender who's been grappling with some of his past life choices and his attempts to start over. Jeff, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Can you just quickly explain your story, what got you to prison and how it's been since you got out?
I was diagnosed with general anxiety disorder, and I was prescribed Xanax. And one night I had taken too many, and I wandered into a house, and I was arrested for burglary. I was given a 3-year sentence, and I served 2 of them out of 3. When I was released from prison, there was no programs for me to reintegrate me back into society. I was given 8 hours notice that I was leaving the facility and put back into the world. So it's been tough. I've only been out for about, I think last Monday I got out. When you look for jobs online, it's a lot of them want to know about your criminal background, and it makes it very difficult.
Aside from finding jobs, which obviously is very, very important, what are the other pieces of the transition back to life outside that are the biggest struggles for you, Jeff?
I guess the biggest struggles for me would be having too much downtime, which is very hard. Financially, right now, is very difficult. In jail, things are provided. When you get out of jail, you're on your own, and DSS is helpful, but leaving jail, they don't help you. They don't set it up for you. It's something you got to do on your own and be proactive about. I wear an ankle bracelet, so a lot of people look at that when you're walking around, and I think they know what it is, and it just puts you in that category as a criminal, and it's very hard to get away from.
How long do you have to wear an ankle bracelet? Do you think that in some ways changes your life once you are a little bit more distant from this time behind bars?
From what I'm told, it's 90 days to wear the ankle bracelet. It's it's tough when you're applying for a job and you got the employer looking down at it, and you got to explain. It goes back to the criminal history and what, you know, what did you do, and was it violent or nonviolent? It's something that for me is very difficult, and I almost feel that people are down upon me because of something like this.
What would you tell employers who may consider hiring an ex-offender to maybe assuage some of their fears, to maybe make them feel like, as we heard from a previous caller, this might be a good thing for them to do as opposed to a potentially very scary thing for them to do?
My history of working is good. It's very good. If you're looking for the chance, I mean, when you get incarcerated, you get sentenced to a certain amount of time. But I feel that it goes beyond that as far as looking for a job. And you need to find an employer that is really going to give you a chance. Your odds of getting a job are reduced to a chance. And it's a matter of time before you find that chance. And it's just between now and that chance is where it gets very difficult financially.
Mm. I want to get to a quick phone call from David in Woodbury. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, everybody. My goodness, I totally believe in the redemption of the soul. Having come from a long line of ministers, I'm not one myself, but I just wish you all the best. We all make mistakes, and some of us make worse ones. But just all the best to all to everybody.
Well, David, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it, and thanks for your kind words.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Jeff Brenneman too for sharing some of your story. Jeff, I wonder in the last minute or so that I have with you, what's next for you? What do you see as your path forward here?
Obviously, I'd like to find a job. I would continue with some kind of therapy to make sure I keep addressing my issues and I don't go back to any prescription medication that is targeted towards anxiety, and just move forward and try and forget the past, but at the same time, remember where I was.
I would assume that in remembering where you were, there's a big learning experience in there for you. It's things that you know you need to change before you can move forward.
Exactly. And I mean, parole is helping with that. As far as I'm going through the connections to work on my therapy, to work on my issues, and as long as you stick with it and are dedicated, I think the end result will be good.
Well, Jeff Brenneman, thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you the best. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, John.
We've got a few tweets and Facebook messages from people. Gideon's Trumpet tweets at us that reentry is irrelevant without probation reform. Probation, he writes, is a nightmare. Extremely long terms, harsh conditions, zero tolerance. He continues, you also need judges and prosecutors who, on probation violations, understand that prison isn't the answer. That's not reality. We also got a Facebook message from Stephen Haynes who says, barriers to employment, finding it, keeping it on both sides of the relationship are, to say the very least, complex. Safe to say that one of the largest barriers to employment is discrimination against ex-offenders, which is rife. Beyond that, many jobs that are available to our clients place in the category of working poor. You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. You can also tweet us at Where We Live and also find us on Facebook at Where We Live. Britt Hill produced our program today with Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Kitty Tolarski is the executive producer of our show. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.